Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me this week are Jeff Ranke and Anna Wells. We each have more than 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we take the five most popular stories on our websites and discuss the implications they have on the industry moving forward. Before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube at IEN Magazine so you can join us when we go live every Thursday. You can also subscribe to, what are the other things? Oh, our daily newsletter. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. That's a good one, too. Jeff, how are you doing this week?
I am well, David. Yourself?
Yeah. I'm doing well. You know, it's always good to get constructive, critical feedback from our viewers and listeners. You know, that's
and you're good. Always so good in just rolling with it,
always too. Really good with rolling with it. Yep. It's just like, hey, we really like it. Maybe it's too long. I still like it. I like the nuggets, the gems, but maybe it's too long. Either way, I got to adjust my viewing habits. I'm probably still going to watch everything. I'm just like, what does that mean? We all love you. Please stay.
Mm-hmm. Please stay.
Anna, how are you doing this week?
I am good. And I just want to say that what David is getting at here is the more constructive, the better.
Yeah.
In terms of feedback. So please, tips and tricks.
Oh, gotcha.
He loves them. Just
yeah. Oh, like the more feedback, constructive or not. Because either way, it weighs heavy.
All of David's family knows about this feedback.
Oh,
every bit of it.
That's right. They do. I mean, actually, it's probably coming from them with their aliases. Their many aliases.
Dear Diary.
This is going to be great for my journal later, guys. All right. Before we get started with our first story this week, we have a word from our new sponsor. 10 years ago, many were skeptical about the predicted 1.5 million battery electric vehicle sales by 2021. Nonetheless, reality has surpassed expectations. Today, experts foresee continued growth in the plug-in vehicle market. Well, a new white paper from Parker covers 9 emerging trends that are shaping the future of electric transportation and how they are impacting other industries. So download the white paper, 9 Emerging Trends in Electric Transportation, right now. In the comments section, in the body copy, click it, read it, let us know what you think. All right, our first story this week. Elon Musk. Funny, we have an Elon Musk story. Says first human has received Neuralink impact.
Implant.
Oh, it's going to make an impact.
First, I thought you were calling Elon Musk funny. Like he's a comedian or something, but.
Not funny. He's a most serious man. The first human has received an implant from Neuralink and is recovering well. That's what Elon Musk shared with the world on Monday via X, his social media platform. He says that, quote, initial results show promising neuron spike detection for the company's computer brain interface. Details are scant, but last year, Neuralink began recruiting people with quadriplegia due to cervical spinal cord injuries or ALS, which is also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. Musk says the first product will be called telepathy and will enable patients to control a phone or computer just by thinking. The patients should also be able to control other devices via their phones. Musk says on X, or he X's, quote, imagine if Stephen Hawking could communicate faster than a speed typist or auctioneer. That is the goal. Anna, your thoughts on some of the news, perhaps some of the timing coming from Neuralink and its most recent implant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a great goal. Again, as you said, scant on the details, which is like one part of this whole thing that I think is challenging to hear because you don't. I'd like to know more about what's happening here.
Yeah.
But yes, the timing of this is interesting because it aligned with another moment in the news cycle for Neuralink that we covered earlier this week about Neuralink having been fined by, of all agencies, the Department of Transportation. Mm-hmm. Why, you ask? So the DOT says that Neuralink has been transporting hazardous materials, having not registered itself officially as a transporter of hazardous materials, which is a compliance misstep. And they fined Neuralink about $2,500. They said that the fine would have been more, but Neuralink has agreed that they're going to fix this problem, remedy it by, I guess, applying. But the DOT also said that Neuralink was improperly packaging hazardous waste, including what they said was xylene, which is a flammable liquid that they described with exposure can cause severe symptoms, even death.
Ooh.
So serious.
Yeah, don't mess with that.
Yeah, exactly. So so this brush with regulators has brought some commentary, obviously, from observers. There's a longtime critic of Neuralink. It's a group called the Physicians Committee of Responsible Medicine, or PCRM. They told writers that the violations, quote, once again reveal the company's sloppy, unsafe practices. Now, PCRM has historically objected to not just the use of primates in testing, but really the overall practice of these implantables in general, which they say are difficult to repair. They feature risks of severe medical complications. So obviously, I think they're trying to suggest here that Neuralink has not earned our trust.
Right.
And that this, you know, with the stakes being so high here, you can see why they want to shed some light on that. To be honest, personally, I have some mixed feelings about this. You know, we've talked about Neuralink before, and I think, you know, I fully support trials and experimental treatment for conditions that warrant that. Mm-hmm. I know people deal with debilitating conditions and they feel like they're confronted with a bunch of dead ends. And so if this gives them an alternative when there's nothing else, I mean, ALS, I mean, that's horrible, right?
Right. Yeah.
So I guess I hope that this company, deserves the trust of these patients. Mm-hmm. It's hard to know that right now, if that's true or not. I hope that the company being remiss in some of these details is not the red flag that it might look like.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, viewing that, it's hard to not take that away at least a little bit, thinking like, why are they not on top of these, even just these procedural or paperwork issues that should be under control?
No, it's really hard to kind of reconcile the two stories, right? Because this is, you know, any hope that they can bring to these people or ability to, you know, make their lives a little bit easier. Fantastic, right? But then the genuine concerns over their inability to bag and tag garbage correctly, you know, it makes it difficult, right? Like, it's hard to put your trust in an operation that has those missteps.
It does. And it would be nice if we knew a little bit more about this, this person. I know that there's patient privacy stuff happening and maybe, you know, maybe they don't want the publicity of it, but just, you know, can we get a picture of them holding a copy of today's paper so we know that they're okay? Like, just hearing it from Elon Musk, it's like, well, okay. Like, he's very, you know, notorious for overpromising and under-delivering. So it's hard for me to take that at face value, unfortunately, just because it's him. But
no, it's crazy how that has changed from, you know, kind of not always, but somewhat trusting what he said a little bit more to now just like the biggest grain of salt.
Yeah, like whatever. Yeah. We'll see. Yeah.
Sure. Jeff, kind of compared to this reminds me of the recent story we covered with the patient who received the pig heart, right? Where it was just like, hey, any additional time is fantastic, right? But there was a little bit more transparency there. And so there was a little bit more believability. And even though, you know, they were willing to share results, knowing that there's likely going to be a negative outcome in the near future. And it's just odd to me that Neuralink will come out and tease these things. You know, first implants in, it's called telepathy, discuss.
Well, and that's where the red flag comes for me. Quite honestly, even though obviously it's a negative and it's a huge mistake or misstep, when you look at the DOT fines and that whole situation there, yes, that raises concerns. But it's also within the context of a startup culture, within a startup organization, you can see how these things might happen. Okay.
Yeah.
That is not as big a red flag to me as the very simple fact that Elon Musk felt compelled to tweet this out.
Yeah.
This is a device that is going to be in clinical trials for over 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't even know about this. This isn't something you publicize or promote because you're not going to talk about it. You're not going to give out a lot of information because you're collecting data right now. That's all you're doing. He had some brave soul who was willing to step up and try this out and to see what would happen, probably because there aren't any other options really available. So they do deserve a lot of – that individual, that patient deserves a lot of credit and appreciation for what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
but you don't have to exodus. We can't say tweet anymore. You shouldn't be putting this out there.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be so long. Plus, like the article referenced, there's 40 other companies doing this.
Yeah, exactly.
And then we also have Syncron out there who has a very similar type of implantable device that they're getting ready to actually manufacture and produce. Where I'm going with all of this is patience is not an Elon Musk quality that we see exercised very well, let me think, ever.
Yeah.
So that's where my concern is. He may have a great product and process here and his heart might be in the right place, but if he doesn't have the right mentality to steer this company properly, that's where it's going to fall down, and that's where my bigger concerns are. Mm-hmm. If he actually has the patience and the wherewithal to put himself second and get off the pedestal and let the development of this actually happen with the people who know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. This is more complicated even than a car,
mm-hmm.
okay, or launching rockets. This is different. The other thing that worries me is when we go back to where Neuralink started, it wasn't necessarily about solving medical conditions. It was about enhancing the intellect of human beings.
Yeah.
It was about helping us keep pace with artificial intelligence. So let's just fast forward 7 years and say Neuralink works. Let's just say he figures it all out. Is he going to be able to stop? No. He was one of the guys who signed that letter saying, hey, we're not going to let AI go off the rails and everything else. But is he really going to be able to stop and say, you know what? We've figured out how to solve all these horrible diseases and give these people back their lives. That's enough.
Mm-hmm.
Of course not. So those are the red flags for me when it comes to Neuralink.
Well, when you talk about the red flags, for any startup, boxes don't get checked. Things, you know, people miss on compliance things. But when you look at this under the lens of a Musk-run operation where – I mean, it was just a couple months ago where we talked about Neuralink insiders talking about being pushed too fast and having unrealistic deadlines. Yeah. That's when it's like, okay, this isn't just a misstep by a startup. This is just one of another thing, just another thing that kind of is a mistake as a result of moving too fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's not, it completely shifts your opinion on it. And, you know, we like harped on Musk for cutting marketing and communications from his company, any company that he's involved with. But then like in turn, you know, like he bought Twitter, his own social media platform to use for his outreach efforts. And like, I kind of wish we could just go back to the old ways where it was just like, you know what? And they said nothing. It was great.
Mm-hmm.
Like something bad happened at Neuralink. We reached out for comments. They have not responded. I just miss those days.
Well, that was the thing. Neuralink didn't actually do anything. They re-exed his ex message.
You can say
whatever.
Tweet.
They re-exed.
Can you just not, say tweet? That sounds.
Just say it.
I mean, that's a horrible verb, but that's actually somehow better
tell
than
on you.
Exed.
Yeah, he re-exed it.
Yeah.
Because
nobody else did anything. Neuralink didn't put anything out there. It was just Musk.
Oh, I know.
So that's what, you know, to your point, you kind of wonder if how this is going to flow here in terms of him trying to run this company with a bunch of people who are a lot smarter than him.
I know. That's the comm strategy. Just like, I'll X something and you re-X it. Done.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my goodness. The other thing that I was kind of looking at is that little tidbit about how because you'll be able to control your phone, you'll then be able to control anything else that can be tethered to your phone.
Mm-hmm.
Should we still call it a phone? I mean, is it like, I mean, or is it just the fact that the definition of a phone and what it is and the purpose it serves has evolved. And so, you know, what was known as a phone 10 years ago is completely different now. And so because that has evolved, it could still stay as a term.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. We still call whatever I use every day a phone, but how much time do I spend actually talking on that phone?
Like less than
1%. That's like, yeah, exactly. That's like a very small use case of what that device is for me.
But it's like people tried to like rebrand it as like your device. Mm-hmm. And that just somehow seems even more cold and dead.
Your device.
Yes. Get off your device. John Dearden, who's joining us live. It's always good to hear from you, John. He says probably a minimum of 5 to 10 years in testing and clinical trials. And again, like to Jeff's point, quiet years.
Yeah.
Quiet years.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Our next most popular story this week. GM delays shift because of the Detroit Lions. It was history in the making. The NFL's lovable losers, the Detroit Lions, had the Super Bowl in its sights. Then, well, the Lions lined it up real well
just a real lining mess. But up until the silver and blue blew it, the community rallied around the team, including General Motors. GM delayed an entire third shift at a Flint, Michigan assembly plant so employees could watch the Lions fall to the San Francisco 49ers in the NFC Championship, despite holding a 17-point lead at the half. The shift was delayed 1 hour, and not only was it a nice gesture to employees, but it was significant when you consider that the plant builds the Chevy Silverado and the GMC Sierra, two of the top 10 selling vehicles in the United States. UAW Local 598 shop chairman Eric Welter cheered the move, even though employees will lose an hour of pay. He said, quote, "They don't want to work it anyhow, so no one is complaining about losing the hour's pay." It should be noted that this wasn't part of a regular 40, but it was overtime. Anna, your thoughts on GM delaying a shift, you know, so that way they could all watch the Lions give it their best shot.
You are really coming after the Lions here. Did you lose some money on that game?
No, but it wasn't the Packers.
Yeah.
Go hard.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm going hard in on the Lions.
You don't need
line it up real good.
You don't need to ease up on the Lions.
Mm-mm.
Just give it to them.
Yeah.
They did lose for
tough
the record.
Room.
They did lose for the record.
They did lose for the record after a commanding lead.
Thought.
Almost like they got a little complacent.
Lead.
Well,
that is a commanding lead.
On the road? No,
yeah.
It's not.
Okay. Okay. The Lions homer over here.
I guess.
Absolutely not.
Jeff.
Well, so Anna.
Yeah.
Back on what GM actually made this choice. Mm-hmm. One thing that stood out to me with the story is that the first time I heard the expression was like, how much money you lose. I can't remember. What is it? Like $1 million for a minute of downtime or something like that? Hour of downtime. I remember that as always being related to automotive first. I mean, then it became kind of manufacturing industry-wide in terms of downtime. But, I mean, downtime in the auto industry is expensive. And even though it was an hour, GM kind of went out of its way here to do something good for its employees.
Yeah. First of all, I would love to see where that originated, that figure, and then how it's like been mutilated over the years for like every minute, every second of downtime, $10 million.
Yeah, $10 million is lost.
Just like, okay. Something like that. I think there's more to it than that. At its core, yes, this is about improving circumstances in the workplace, right? Manufacturing is often challenged with offering some of the perks that you get in other areas, like flexibility. It's hard to get flexibility when you work on a production line. Mm-hmm. And so I think creative solutions to that problem are a must, because you have to make your workplace competitive, and this is a good way to do it. Like, they saw the opportunity to do that. You're kind of keeping up with the requests of a contemporary workforce. Mm-hmm. But it does two things, in my opinion. It shows employees that you're willing to flex to accommodate their wants and needs. It's a good boost for morale that way. And it doesn't take much on GM's part, because they're not giving anyone paid time off. And they're not really losing production progress, because as the union rep contends, it is overtime. And his direct quote was, they'll make it up somewhere else.
Yeah.
So they're already planning to get that done, right? Secondly, I think from a practical standpoint, it's going to save this plant from the headache of dealing with the uncertainty of a bunch of people calling in.
Yeah.
Because you know that would happen.
Yeah, just widespread fevers in the Flint area.
Suddenly everyone is very sick that day. And, important football games have set a precedent of being influential in work attendance. I read that the day after the Super Bowl, millions of people typically call in sick, to the point where it's earned itself the name the Super Sick Monday. Have you guys heard that before?
I've participated in it.
Super Sick Monday.
I've participated in Super Sick Monday, even if it was on a plane sometimes.
So they were trying to avoid their own Super Sick Sunday, I think, by doing this. So to me, it was like equal parts, nurturing your culture a bit, but then also, practically speaking, let's try to make sure that people show up.
Right. And a lot of goodwill, I think, I don't know, but maybe not. Maybe some of the employees think it was trivial. Jeff Nolan, who is joining us live.
Oh, boy.
He says, if Dan Campbell had just kicked field goals, these workers could have had another shortened shift this month.
Yep.
I disagree.
Jeff, what?
How do you?
They ran the numbers. They said the chances of Detroit winning that, even if they would have made both field goals, which you don't know they would have, still only gave them less than a 1% better chance of winning that game.
Mm-hmm. Buggy. Jeff Analytics over here.
What was that?
John Dearden says trade shows in Mexico during the World Cup. No carpets installed.
Yeah, that I believe.
Oh, yeah.
I believe that.
Nobody's there. See,
I think you guys are missing the fact that this is actually a huge conspiracy.
Oh, yeah.
By the Detroit automakers. Huge. They were obviously trying to divide the UAW by GM giving workers time off, and Stellantis and Ford did not. They were trying to just increase that competitive dynamic amongst the automakers and spread that amongst the workers.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly.
Clearly.
I mean, after all.
Divide and conquer.
The Lions do play at Ford Field. Do you think GM would have given the time off if it was a home game? No. Obviously, I mean, very cool, okay, by GM to do this. Makes a lot of sense for all the reasons that you just mentioned. I think one of the things that kind of struck me is the fact that there's a third shift. You know, I think that is kind of unique. The number of manufacturing plants that are doing third shift has actually declined in recent years. However, manufacturing is the industry with the most third shift workers. Something like almost 7% of all manufacturing jobs are third shift.
Wow.
Which I thought was kind of high, almost 3 million across the U.S. So it illustrates a lot of different factors, a lot of things you guys already talked about. But I think when you look at just the third shift and the impact that it can have on a bigger picture when you don't even really think about people going to work at 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night. Very interesting in terms of the adjustments they had to make, probably to their production schedules and everything else.
No, a significant portion of my family, you know, my dad and my brothers, they've all worked, my mother all worked third shift. And it's an incredible sacrifice that they make for the family. And I mean, it's somewhat of an opportunity because there are premiums there to be on those shifts, but it is a sacrifice that you make. And I mean, obviously, I'm getting real comfortable up here because sorry about that near slip there. What kind of shape do you think those workers were in?
Shape.
They were, you
did
know.
Did I not say shape?
No, you did, but you started slow on it.
I started. It was a slow shape?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What kind of, they were in ship shape. What kind of shape do you think the workers were in emotionally and physically when they got to the shop there?
I mean, for Lions fans, I'm sure they were thrilled just to make it this far. Heartbreaking loss, all of those things. I don't know.
But as far as
physically,
yeah.
I mean, it's probably a mixed bag, right?
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest. You'd hope that anybody operating heavy equipment definitely have maybe turned the faucet off at halftime. But yeah.
Well, it's just for me because it's like it's immediately after the game. And I know like when you're in that room watching the big game and any big game for your team, you know, like, and it's just devastation. And I can't imagine being in that room and just be like, all right, well, off to work then, you know, just like, no, go crawl in the dark hole and like hang out for an evening. Nolan disagrees that analytics, he says analytics in an elimination game or an elimination tournament be damned.
Ooh.
Okay. Anyway,
Ford and Stellantis didn't exactly follow suit. Ben Munson, who put this together, he kind of poked at Ford a little bit because they like put together a really sweet hype video hey, we're all in this together. Everything's going to operate the same. Stellantis, at least to their credit, came out and said through a spokesperson, quote, while we celebrate that success and root for another win against the San Francisco 49ers, Stellantis will run normal production schedules on Sunday to meet the expectations of our customers and dealers.
No snow days at Stellantis.
Right?
Ever.
Boo! Just a huge bummer. Like, okay. I mean, that's like the person that's like, no, I have to study.
Mm-hmm.
And just can't make the party. All right. Stellantis, you buzzkill. Our next most popular story. Country's tallest skyscraper planned for unlikely U.S. city. When you think of a spot for the tallest skyscraper in the United States, what cities come to mind? Chicago, L.A., New York City, maybe Milwaukee? Nah, it's not Milwaukee. Well, real estate development firm Madison Capital and architecture firm AO are planning a new project in, guesses, Oklahoma City. They're calling it the Boardwalk at Bricktown.
Bricktown is a, quote, industrial, chic, and lively entertainment district with repurposed warehouse spaces turned into restaurants, piano lounges, and chic wine bars. That's two chics.
Two chics, yeah. Two chics in one.
One chic, Bricktown.
Two chics in the wind.
Mm-hmm.
What?
No chic. The companies recently requested to increase the height of the project's central tower. If approved, it will be the tallest building in the United States and the fifth tallest in the world. The development is expected to include three towers that each reach 345 feet and a fourth Legends Tower that will top out at 1,907 feet. The height coincides with the year Oklahoma became the 46th state in the United States. The mixed-use development will include two Hyatt hotels with nearly 200 residential service condominiums, along with another 1,528 residential units. It will also feature a retail and restaurant district with more than 110,000 square feet of space, along with a public observatory, restaurant, and bar at the top of the Legends Tower. Jeff, did you see renderings? Of yes. What this would look like in the area?
Yeah, it definitely stands out.
Yeah. Just
definitely stands out.
Just like, hey, look at this flat land for miles in this massive tower hanging out of it.
Yeah. Oklahoma City is an interesting situation right now. I did not realize this, but it's one of the fastest growing cities in the U.S. And one of the reasons for that is because when they set up the city way back when it was founded, essentially they annexed just a huge swath of land. Okay. So it's very spread out. You're not crowded intentionally. That's the way the city founders wanted it to be. So as a result, there is land available, mm-hmm. and it's not super high priced like you see in every other growing geography.
It's like reverse Atlanta?
Kind of, yeah, okay. Basically. Okay. I mean, when you look at it, it's kind of interesting. When you look at the square area of Oklahoma City, it's larger than New York City, but the population is a tenth. Mm. So it's there's a lot of opportunity there. So you can see why Oklahoma City is growing. We look at Canoe as a big manufacturer that's actually housed there.
Okay.
And it has been growing. But with that growth has come along some infrastructure issues. They're talking about challenges in terms of road, utilities, wastewater management, all of these things. So the normal growing pains that would come along with it. So you can see why, along with the fact that it's got a great central location, a good job force, all of these other things, why it would be appealing for this company to build this masterpiece of architecture in Oklahoma City. But are they ready for it? Because yeah. We've seen issues with this before in even more developed and highly populated areas. I mean, look at the skyscraper issues in San Francisco that we've seen come across here.
Yeah.
Now, I know we're not, you know, butting up to an ocean or a bay here, but you just hope this isn't a situation where they see all this wonderful growth and excitement and don't go too fast too soon.
And it starts leaning.
Or worse, yes.
Yeah. I mean, John raises a point that a lot of people raised on the website. Hey, this is Hurricane Alley.
Tornado Alley.
Or Tornado Alley. Tornado Alley. He says the heck with being at the top during that. Jesse agrees and says, oh, heck no.
Thank you for watching your language, Jesse. We try to keep this a PG show.
The family podcast.
It normally is. I don't know. You know, you have a free sandwich at lunch and then the gloves are off. I was kind of curious because, like, it looks like you would just be adding so many people in such a tiny footprint. Like, when you look at it's kind of crazy to look at the rendering next to where they plan on building this. And it's like this little L-shaped property that used to be like a parking lot. You're just like, oh, that's all going to fit right there, huh?
It looks hilarious. Kind of. It's like, really? I don't know. I mean, first of all, I do think that in the age of climate change, like, cities do need to focus on density a little bit, right? I mean, you need areas where public transit, walking, biking are suitable. But this might be overkill, and it might be a pipe dream too. So the zoning hurdles are such that some have even speculated that this could be a publicity stunt.
Right.
And you kind of understand that thinking when you look at the actual zoning law in this project area, which allows for buildings no higher than 300 feet. So this proposed tower, as you said, is almost 2,000 feet. So I think we are safe in saying that we've seen projects derailed over much less.
Yeah.
That is really no small ask in terms of getting that approved. And secondly, I don't know, like, So people who are supporting the project are saying, like, you know, this makes Oklahoma City maybe a destination as well. It's a city that's not really known for possessing a tourism-based economy. So maybe the reason it's in such an unlikely location is because it would make such an impact on this specific city in that sense, because a standout attraction for the city would be great. But, you know, as John said and other people are saying, there are some concerns about, for real, the tornadoes. And, you know, with climate change, I don't think you can discount the fact that that they may become more frequent. And if you look at Oklahoma City's history, they've been struck by more than a dozen violent tornadoes, which means F4 or F5. That's crazy, right? And many, many smaller ones. So I know that doesn't mean it's going to rip through the downtown every time, or, you know, but you can sort of see why people are pointing to that and maybe asking for a risk assessment. And I think that that assessment, you know, maybe we'll go into the zoning considerations on whether or not this is actually a good idea for the city. Mm-hmm. So it's cool, I guess, in theory, but I just don't know if it's going to happen.
Would this, say this attraction is built, is this an attraction that you would consider, you know, taking the family to see?
No.
I just don't see
it. I mean, not
a
for
whole
me,
lot
but...
else there. I spent some time in Oklahoma when I was in the Army. It's great if you're from Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like maybe take in a Thunder game and see the big building and go, neat.
There's people out there who love landmarks, and I think people would go see it.
Yeah.
But the challenges that come along with it, as you said, Jeff, like, I mean, it's just from an engineering standpoint, this is like, got to have a lot of considerations and materials and things like that. It's going to be very expensive to build. It's going to be very expensive to support. And then also with the weather considerations, what do you have to put into it there to make sure that it can withstand whatever comes their way? I don't know if it's going to be worth it.
Well, I think, I mean, maybe it could be used as a testament for that. There have been numerous projects that work on making buildings safer for extreme weather events. Really, a lot of that technology has been out there for a while. It's just whether or not the developers have chosen to use it. And, you know, if they make it right, it could be a testament to modern engineering, you know, and that would be incredible.
Right? It would. But do you want to, like, test it out and stay in that hotel in April tornado season like Oklahoma? I don't know if I would.
I'd stay in the hotel. I might shop in the retail center. I don't know that I live there. But hey, great viewpoint. If you're hanging out at like floor, whatever, 190 or whatever it is, 19, no, what would be the top, 19th floor? I don't know. Either way, if you're at the top watching a tornado come in, just be like, all right, they promised me this is solid.
Yeah.
See, my fear of heights, can't even imagine being up that high. Oh, like looking out, terribly afraid of heights.
Like to the point where like just thinking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you getting dizzy right now?
Not right now, but like I did have a moment reading this when they showed how high up that was above everything else. Yeah. I'm like, if you were looking out there, like it did actually make me a little squirmish. Absolutely.
And it's like, I wonder if you could feel the building move, you know?
You could with the Sears Tower. Yeah. Like when the wind was blowing, you could feel that up there.
No, thank you. Yeah, keep it.
Just one more thing I want to throw out there. Wrangell, Alaska has the third largest square mileage for a city in the U.S. Guess how many people live there?
In Wrangell?
Wrangell, Alaska, 2,500 square miles the city takes up.
Okay.
How many people do you think live there?
Oh, God.
250.
David,
I don't know.
You blow it when you under... Yeah.
Are you the guy who bets a dollar for everything
yes,
on the prices, right?
Mm-hmm. Dollar.
Yeah. you gotta play ball here with Jeff.
Okay, fine.
25,000.
250,000.
2,000.
2,000.
You're railing on my 250?
That's so low.
Oh my goodness.
That's such a low number.
I was remarkably close.
You were.
So much close. What'd you say?
25,000.
25,000. I stand.
Way,
I win.
Way to go, David.
Yeah, showcase.
You're
showdown,
so,
David,
you're
right
so
now.
You're so good at guessing things.
You won both showcases, David.
We're so proud of you. Way to go.
I mean, thank you both for acknowledging my achievements at winning this.
Enjoy your Toyota Celica.
I will. Actually, we'll get to that in a later story.
Pay taxes on the way out.
According to the OKC Free Press, this is a quote. For native Cityans, the idea of putting such a large development on what they know to be a moderate-sized L-shaped parking lot in Bricktown may sound like sheer fantasy. And then they go on to say, writing press releases is an easier process than actually achieving the change.
It's not wrong.
No, just throwing some heat. Carrie, who's watching us live, says, you should see him at an auction.
This guy?
Yeah, I believe that.
Does he say $1 every time?
I mean, you got to start somewhere.
I can see him at the garage sales for sure.
It's, haggling at a rummage sale? Quarter. And then, like, you haggle him down to a quarter and you have to pay him in a dollar and get change back. But also the exhilaration of an auction, all of a sudden you're off the rails and you don't know if you're going to pay your mortgage that month. Whew, that's exhilarating too. All right. Our next most popular story. Boeing 757 loses nose while preparing for takeoff. Nose wheel. Having some important drops on these early reads. I apologize. Last week, a Delta Airlines Boeing 757 lost a nose wheel while preparing for takeoff in Atlanta. According to the FAA, Delta Flight 982 was taxiing for departure on its way to Bogota, Colombia, around 11:15 a.m. when the wheel came off. Literally. No one was injured, not the 172 passengers, two pilots, or four flight attendants. And the tire was put back on before it was put back into service the next day. Now, this is a 32-year-old plane and not the troubled 737 MAX, but problems continue to pile up for Boeing. Boeing stopped making the 757 nearly 20 years ago. But, Anna, is this too much smoke for there not to be a fire, or is this simply piling on with the story?
You're right. They're not the same planes. But this string of mishaps have been heavily covered in the media. And while it's been a bit of a mix in terms of where the fingers have been pointed, is it the airlines? Is it regulatory agencies? It's Boeing's manufacturing practices. The one constant is the Boeing name coming up over and over again.
Yeah.
And if that were not enough, the LA Times recently interviewed a man named Ed Pearson, who's a former senior manager at Boeing's 737 factory in Renton, Washington. This is the 737, so this is not the Delta plane with the nose wheel. Mm-hmm. However, it is the type of plane where the door cap flew off the plug in mid-flight. So he bluntly told the newspaper that he would absolutely not fly a MAX airplane. Mm-hmm. And he says this is because of what he was witness to, what he contends was basically immense pressure at that Renton factory for those workers to get those planes out the door.
Yep.
So Pearson, incidentally, is the director of the Foundation for Aviation Safety, and he has basically built a career on this topic. So take that for whatever way you want. But he says he urged Boeing to shut down production on the MAX jets prior to the two crashes, the one in 2018 and one in 2019. Due to concerns that he had over safety, and he was reportedly ignored. He made it his mission since to shed light on this. Mm-hmm. And while he is a podcaster and a speaker on this topic, he did also testify before Congress, which I think may speak to his veracity a little bit. But now back to the 757. Okay, so again, not the same plane.
Mm-hmm. Is it the same plane?
Not.
It's not. Okay. These are two different planes.
For those listening at home, these are not the same planes.
But I do think it does strike a bit of fear in observers if you have repetitive problems paired with this former high-level Boeing official, like right now, making these statements about rushed production. Things like missing bolts on the Alaska Airlines door plug, I think, obviously speak to that. Does a wheel problem on a plane that left Boeing's factory 32 years ago? Probably not.
Yeah.
Okay. But it doesn't help. And I think the incidents with the MAX, as well as the narrative around poor quality, rushed production, lack of response to quality concerns, as this narrative continues, there's going to be a ton of pressure on Boeing to clean up this mess. You know, I don't know that it, unfortunately, I don't know that it matters that it's a different plane.
Well, and as Boeing clearly needs to tighten up its manufacturing practices, like Joe said, who's watching us live. Thank you for joining us, Joe. You know, it's more like a poor maintenance or a maintenance problem at a 30-year plus old aircraft. But maybe this is going to force Boeing to really push when it comes to maintenance as well. Just like, hey, everything needs to get better here. And I mean, you're right. Boeing has been the common denominator in all this. But on many of these stories, there is a lot of shared culpability here.
There is, but at the same time, whether or not this has anything to do with their current factory problems, this is all getting lumped together into what is going on with Boeing. Boeing needs to fix their problems.
Yeah. Jeff, one of the things that also stood out to me is that specifically they used the term in this article that the plane needed to be retired before it was put back into service. And I just thought that was really cute because I'm like, oh my goodness, they had to retire it. I'm like, oh no,
nope.
They had to retire the plane. And you know what? For the sake of clarity, maybe next time just say they had to put a new tire on.
That would have been better.
That would have been a little better.
Yes. Did you hear the sort of the dialogue from the tower talking to the pilot?
No.
Basically saying, yeah, because basically they were at a stop.
Yeah.
And one of the, there's two tires on the front nose, and one of them basically just rolled down the hill. And that's what they said to the pilot.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got a problem. Your nose plane tire is rolling down the hill. And the guy's like, what? They had to explain what was going on. So it did look kind of crazy. I think getting back to your where there's smoke, there's fire sort of analogy, I think with this story as well as the next one we're going to talk about, there is this element of culture and how it can just permeate into everything. Now, this isn't a Boeing-run organization when you look at Delta Airlines.
Mm-hmm.
However, they're very closely integrated. I mean, they couldn't be more closely integrated.
Right.
So you have to feel if there is a consensus or a mood or whatever you want to say at Boeing that says, get it out the door, that's going to come down to the technicians and mechanics who are saying, get it up in the air.
Yeah.
And when you look at things that have been going on with the airlines, we all know the issues that they had for 2 years during a global pandemic, and now things are ramping up, prices are higher, all of these things, there's a definite push to recoup all of those lost dollars. You can see that also permeating down to the technicians and mechanics cutting corners, not doing what they should. You combine that with the fact that there is a huge shortage of aircraft mechanics right now. Right now, on an annual basis, they're running about 12,000 technicians short per year.
Hmm.
And the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is saying they're going to need another 17,000 potentially over the next 10 years.
Yeah.
So there is a huge issue there. So when you combine the fact that we don't have enough of the people turning wrenches, combined with the fact that they're being pushed to do it quicker, faster, get it out there, get it going, we don't want to be on time, that does set up for a lot of things like this, which could have been so much worse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank God this happened while they're just standing on the runway as opposed to trying to take off or land.
Right.
That front, kind of interesting. Sorry, cut you off.
No. But I mean, that was one thing that also stood out to me was the people who were commenting on the story being like, well, that's why there's two. They would have been fine. I'm like, okay, I get it that you like, you know, you're defending Boeing here. But like the argument is not that's why there's two tires in case one falls off.
And just to put that into a little bit more perspective, those tires handle 26,000 pounds of weight. Yeah. That's what they're responsible for.
Yeah.
So if you lose one, that is a big deal.
It's a lot of weight.
You're down 13,000 pounds of support. How would you do without that, David?
I don't know. I was, just put a little kink in my knee and I haven't been able to support myself very well at all. It's the reason I got like a permanent lean now. I pulled out the same quotes from Ed Pearson as well. And you paraphrase the second one, but he told the LA Times, I've worked in the factory where they were built and I saw them pressure employees, the pressure employees were under to rush the planes out the door. And I guess I didn't know the context that he had sort of essentially made a career of Boeing bashing. But so is Joe Jacobson, the other engineer quoted in the story, is he in the same
I don't know.
Speaking tour?
I don't know.
Because for me, it was about like the optics. Is that like, I hate the term, the optics are bad. I mean, they're no longer bad, right? It's wholly bad because these former managers and engineers are like lining up to blow the whistle.
Mm-hmm.
And they also are, you know, trying to keep people off of these 737 MAX 9 jets. Joe Jacobson, who I mentioned, he's an engineer. He said that he would tell his family to avoid the MAX. He realized that profits were prioritized over quality control. Will that ever stop? I mean, will that ever stop, do you think?
Is that a rhetorical question?
I don't know. I guess I put it as a rhetorical question, but do you think that there will ever be a time when profits are not prioritized over quality control? Just because it seems like it comes up a lot of weeks with many different manufacturers where it's just like, what's got to happen in order for there to be real change?
I mean, it's a fair question when you consider how much the MAX groundings and crashes in 2018 and 2019 cost Boeing as a company. Mm-hmm. To see this stuff resurface just a handful of years later is concerning.
Well, and as a person who's going to fly Delta next week, most likely on a Boeing aircraft, mm-hmm. it's like I've never in my life felt compelled to like email the airline and be like, hey, no worries. Just wondering, what am I flying on?
Well, this is where we get into sort of that vicious circle too of, well, shouldn't the government get involved? Shouldn't there be more regulations, more fines or whatever? And you don't want that to be the case because you want private industry to basically monitor itself and just do the right thing because it makes sense. But if they're not going to, yes. and they become such an ingrained part of a certain supply chain, you've got two options when it comes to these planes.
Yeah.
Okay. You've got Boeing or Airbus basically. So when that's the case, what is there other than just being a decent human being or whatever, yeah. contributor to life on this planet, what is Boeing's incentive to do things differently than they have in the past? That's what's really sad.
Well, and I think that's where I think the FAA was really exposed in this entire Boeing situation, MAX situation, where I think it is on FAA and regulators to really realize, hey, okay, they're not going to police themselves. Yeah. We need to ramp it up. And I mean, it's, we talk about all these other regulators needing, teeth, essentially, being able to do something. But a lot of these stories, like when it comes out, it shows how like the FAA was kind of like not in on it, but kind of let Boeing run the show.
Well, it's just so tough because Boeing is so ingrained. We've talked about like 49% of their business comes from the Department of Defense and similar types of organizations. I mean, when you've got the government fully ingrained with a private company like this too,
yeah,
those are, you're going to have blurry lines. So what actually causes Boeing to check themselves a little bit here? I don't know what more it can be. It's certainly not bad press because that isn't hindering them at all.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, is it realistic that there could be the emergence of another aircraft manufacturer that could emerge? Or is that just so far out of the picture?
Talk to Elon Musk.
Oh, God.
Please don't.
No. Hey, we see a real opportunity for you there, Mr. Musk. All right. Our most popular story this week. Toyota chief apologizes for cheating on testing at group company. Again. On Monday, Toyota chief Koji Sato apologized to customers, suppliers, and dealers. This apology involves flawed testing at Toyota Industries Corporation, which makes diesel engines. The testing is required by the Japanese government. False results were uncovered for certification testing and other inspections for engines that claimed the products met standards when they actually didn't. No major accidents have been connected to any of the cheating, but it raises serious questions. We talked about the cheating at Daihatsu Motor last week. That spanned 30 years. In 2022, Hino Motors, a truck maker that is also part of the Toyota Group, admitted faking emissions data as far back as 2003. Production was stopped at Toyota Industries until proper testing can be carried out, but the affected models can continue to drive safely. When asked about the root causes of these many scandals, Sato said, "The companies needed better communication and more training on the importance of complying with the rules." He also admitted that workers were feeling pressure to cut corners. Japanese transport officials raided the plant the next day. This problem will impact some 43,000 vehicles a month in Japan, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia, but not North America. Jeff, it is crazy how many weeks in a row we've had essentially the same story that's like a Mad Lib with a different Toyota subsidiary filled in the first blank.
Great analogy. Yeah. It's pretty pathetic. And I think, again, we're seeing this permeate. I was one of the first one to say, well, you know, as a subsidiary, with Daihatsu there, they were producing lower tier vehicles. Giving them a pass in any way, shape, or form. But you could see maybe how Toyota just wasn't as involved or turned a blind eye or whatever. Again, not justifying it. But now you're getting into this where you're looking at 43,000 vehicles a month. Now, I think it's very interesting that none of these vehicles are coming to North America, okay? Mm. Because, you know, this comes right on the front. We did this story, was it 2 weeks ago or whatever, about Cummins and their $1.6 billion fine for essentially doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Volkswagen, another one. Huge, huge amounts in Europe and North America because of what they're doing. Now, when you look where the majority of these vehicles are being sold, it's pretty close to home. It's Japan, Singapore, and then we get into Africa and the Middle East, where I'm going to guess environmental regulations are not scrutinized anywhere near as heavily as they are here in the US or Europe. Just to give you some perspective, 43,000 vehicles a month. If we're looking at the Clean Air Act, and there is a, this is right from the EPA site, violators are subject to civil penalties of up to $45,268 per non-compliant vehicle or engine.
Ooh.
That gets you above that $1.7 billion mark real quick. I'll save you the math. It's just shy of $2 billion
a big month
that they would potentially be facing if those vehicles, same number of vehicles, were coming to the U.S.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I was still putting the commas in.
Okay, so that's one of the reasons this continues to happen is because potentially this chairman, the spokesperson gets up there, bows to the press audience and it was a sign of humility. Mm-hmm. And that's somehow supposed to just make it all okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No, when we talk about teeth, we can be very critical of the U.S. regulators, but at least they're doing something. In these other areas, nothing is happening. And when you're looking at a giant like Japan or Toyota and all the impact they have in Japan and these other economies, they're going to continue to get away with this until they're held accountable at a much higher level than having to say they're sorry.
Yeah.
That's just the reality of it.
It was shocking to me that it all came down to a real sincere apology. You know, just like,
well,
we promise.
And the thing is, this goes beyond automotive engines. Mm-hmm. This is Toyota Industries.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This is, they are in material handling equipment. They are in construction equipment. They're even into some of these huge like gas and liquid pumps mm-hmm. that you'll see in huge industrial facilities.
Okay.
So this is a much wider spread issue than just the vehicles they're putting out.
Anna, are people not up in arms as much or at all, I guess, because it's just cheating? You know, there's a quote, no major accidents have been mm-hmm. connected to any cheating. And, quote, the models can continue to be driven safely. I feel like when people see those statements, they're just like, oh, you know what? They're just trying to cheat the system.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this in recent weeks with some of the other auto scandals around cheating on tests and how very little brand impact it really had on anyone.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a blip in the news cycle. People forget about that easily. When they want to buy a car, they want their deal and whatever they like, the features and the brand, whatever. I don't think people are really holding on to that information. So
no, because it was, well, you know, last week you guys were kind of holding my feet to the fire about Toyota. And this week it made me think about it again. And it's terrible, but like I had the same thought. Like in the long run, to me, I see it as like, okay, they were cheating against regulators, but compared to other vehicles that I've had, they've been the most reliable. And still I still feel like for my money, like that's where I would potentially invest just because of, but I know, and it's terrible. I'm like, oh man, you're part of a problem. You're part of a broken system. And it's just like, I'm still going to probably buy a Sierra.
But you're not the problem. This time.
Yeah. Way too quick, Jeff. Way too quick.
We'll get back to you on that.
All right.
Carrie, who's watching at home, might
agree.
Whatever,
future times.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. I got to make sure I don't talk over you guys.
It's one of those things, too, where, and I think we talked about this before, too, but when everyone is doing it, then you just, you're like, well, everybody does it. They're all the same. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I don't make a statement with my purchasing dollar because it doesn't matter. They all do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I don't think you're alone.
No, I know. But it's like, it goes back to like our recycling argument, right? Where it's like, you see so many global ecological travesties. And when it comes down to making sure you're not wish cycling, you're kind of just like, eh. You know, it's like you're defeated already. You're just like, what does it matter?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, don't you think this would have a much bigger impact? I know we talked about this a little bit last week too. If this was happening in North American or European markets.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I do. And it is, it's, you know, you point out, it's very interesting to see where it is happening.
Yeah.
You know, where it's awfully quiet and maybe in areas where if you are a little loud about it, maybe there are greater consequences for you for talking about it than mm-hmm. the actual perpetrators.
Exactly. And like the vibe I got from this whole apology and this whole charade of the bowing and contrition thing is just that you were sorry that you got caught because, I mean, because we talked about Daihatsu last week about the accusations that this test manipulation had gone on for 30 years. And for me, like, so Sato said, you know, better communication was needed among the companies, as well as a more thorough education about the importance of complying with rules. If that's truly the case, then Toyota has a Wild West culture. And and if that's happening at its plants and testing facilities, then that is an epic problem. And to be honest, like, if your managers are applying the pressure on the workers to cut corners, who is applying the pressure to them? Because somebody is. And to me, that means that the top-down culture that you have is broken. And so for him to stand there and say, like, oh, yep, it's almost like, sorry, we did, we forgot to send out an email telling people not to, we will get on that and we'll just kind of have a quick meeting about this and then everything will be all buttoned up. Like, I don't, I think it's a much larger problem than that. And I did not feel like they took responsibility.
Didn't you read the no cheating literature hanging up in the break room?
We have a company mission statement, and I would appreciate if you all read it and then DocuSign with your initials that you've read it.
To your point, Anna, I pulled out his quote where he says, we recognize that not only people at the testing site, but also management did not have proper understanding of certification. And I just thought that was one heck of an admission. Just like, oh, not only did they not know what they're doing, but everyone above them didn't know what they're doing. And once again, real sorry about that. Real sorry about that. We'll put together a tutorial as a video and text it to our employees. Should be fine. Wrap it up real nice.
Just, yep. No problems here.
No, it was incredible. Jeff, do you think he realized what he was admitting to when he said that?
Yeah, 100% he did, because the people he was admitting it to are going to be like, yeah, he feels really bad. I can tell. He feels really sorry about
it. Look at his face.
Because this is the way it works here.
He's so upset.
Yeah. And it's not like anybody was hurt. I mean, all we're doing is just, you know, making the earth dirtier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's all it is.
Exactly. We're not going to find out who gets lung cancer from this. So
I mean, and that is the other part of it, right? This wasn't, unlike Daihatsu, which was a huge safety issue that they falsified testing for. This isn't directly a safety. It's not performing unsafe.
Yeah.
It's just not performing to the standard that it's supposed to.
It's just killing our great mother.
Yeah.
All right. Before we move into, in case you missed it, stories maybe not as popular, but, you know, stand to make a big impact on the industry going forward, we have another word from our new sponsor. 10 years ago, many people were skeptical about the predicted 1.5 million battery electric vehicle sales by 2021. Nonetheless, reality has surpassed expectations. Today, experts foresee continued growth in the plug-in vehicle market. Well, this new white paper from Parker covers 9 emerging trends that are shaping the future of electric transportation and how they are impacting other industries. This one's a really good read. So download the 9 emerging trends in electric transportation. Now there's a link in the body copy. There's a link in the comment section. Download it, read it. Mix it up, tear it apart, let us know what you think about it. All right, in case you missed it, stories maybe not as popular on the website, but still stand to make a big impact on the industry going forward. And I'm going to start with you. What do you have this week?
The story I selected is about BMW and a partnership that they just inked with a humanoid robot company. So BMW has established a commercial agreement with California firm Figure in order to deploy general purpose robots along the automaker's production lines. The companies hope to use the bots to automate tedious tasks, blah, 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 you know, freeing up humans for applied skills, like make the bots do all the heavy lifting, so to speak. After a phased start, the goal is to graduate to stage deployments at BMW's Spartanburg, South Carolina plant, and the collaboration also hopes to explore the use of AI. Robert Engelhorn, president and CEO of BMW Manufacturing, said that robots carry the potential to make productivity more efficient, enabling BMW to focus on the transformation ahead of us. That said, a report in Popular Science about this topic blasted the project's goals as being vague, adding that in general, quote, this is a great quote, the sci-fi promise of a relentless, hyper-efficient, never-sleeping robot workforce, for the time being at least, remains mostly speculative. I agree with that. Yeah. And like, how do we feel about this? You know, I am, as you know, sort of skeptical of the idea of a humanoid bot, but I will be watching this for a few reasons. One, Tesla has tried to take the lead on this, as we know, but by unfortunately, in my opinion, trying to create their own humanoid robot from scratch. That is not recommended.
Yeah.
And then BMW also sees the value, but as PopSci says, there's not a ton of detail here. So I don't know. I think that the other addition that they need to point out is that these figure robots, they have to charge after 5 hours. So, you know, not to mention that this design, you know, there's a lot of design challenges that come with this form factor. We know that these things like to tip over.
Oh, just the hands?
Just the hands. The grips, like all that stuff. There really needs to be a lot of progress made before they can be, I mean, you know, they talk about like non-ergonomic tasks and heavy lifting and stuff like that, but like you need to do a lot to these bots before they're ready to do that. There's just a lot to be done there.
Yeah. And for them to be, you know, safe enough to work side by side, an employee like a cobot. I mean, it's kind of scary that, you know, one of the biggest safety concerns is that it could fall on another worker.
Right.
Like, tipping over.
They could tip over. Yeah. And especially if they're lifting, like, I mean, what if they have a heavy load? I mean, that's scary to think about how dangerous forklifts are for that reason. And we could be just putting these like humanoid forklifts just running around.
We don't need larger forklifts. We need larger humanoid, like 3-story tall humanoid robots that can just pick and place pallets. Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, that makes sense.
I don't know.
A much more friendly work environment. Everybody's comfortable with that.
Yeah. Well, people like working alongside humanoid robots. We know that for a fact. Yeah.
So I do believe in the potential of a humanoid robot in the workplace. I do think it'll be realized long term. Near term, though, I do think that, you know, okay, maybe if you install a few of these just to experiment with to see if there's any actual applicability there that has real impacts on time, cost, and efficiency, I get it. But Jeff, I guess part of it for me is that in the interim, while you're experimenting with these, we've seen like 2 or 3 process improvement revolutions in the manufacturing industry, like huge game-changing ones. I'm just surprised that that's not a bridge where all of these processes where we think humanoids could play a role, where they're not working on changing the process rather than the tool.
I think, I get where you're going. Yeah. And that's where I get confused. What is the advantage of a humanoid robot form? Because when we go to these shows and we look at these arms, and what they are capable of doing with the telescoping functionality, the lifting capacities that they now have, just the like the power and capabilities of these robotic arms, why do we need to go to a humanoid platform? That's the part that I always struggle with.
Yeah.
It creeps people out.
Yeah.
It's super expensive. And we're not really – and we keep working at and putting all this money into developing this platform of robotics when we've got really good stuff that if we just kept enhancing that, it seems like it solves the problem on its own.
I totally agree though, because like they say that the reason they want this form factor is because production lines are built for humans, human size, human heights, all that stuff. So humanoid bots by reason, I guess, could do that more efficiently or effectively than what's already out there. But like for all the money, to your point, like, can't you just, I mean, I don't know, you could rebuild that parts of that production line for way less money to accommodate just a regular robot. I don't know.
I also think that part of it is the worker shortage and the skills problem that we have, because it's way easier for people to wrap their heads around, like, you don't have a human worker, here's a robot one, you know, and it's kind of like plug and play.
But again, when we're talking,
I know it's not, but I mean, like, when you think about it and when you're like wrapping your head around it, it's like, okay, you can change the entire way that your factory works, or instead of a human that you need, here's a robot that can do the same, maybe.
Yeah, I guess I struggle with understanding, just even from a footprint perspective, how manufacturing plants want to consolidate space and do more with less physical room. That's where these arms come in, are like perfect and can do so much more than they, I mean, every 6 months, the capabilities are exponentially greater. So the humanoid thing, I just don't buy into it. I don't buy into it for BMW. I don't buy into it for Tesla and a lot of these other places. Some of those early cobot types, they would be cobots now. When we look at like Baxter and some of the other stuff that came out. That is not what they're talking about here.
I
don't see it paying off at the level mm-hmm. that they're anticipating, just from a practicality perspective.
One thing that stands out about the story too is also, again, how far behind the Tesla Optimus is mm-hmm. in terms of real world applications. Yeah.
Yes. And that's why I think, like, if you're going to watch anybody on humanoid bots, like watch BMW, watch anybody else besides Tesla, I think that this will, they will find application for this a little bit faster and maybe debunk some of the benefits of it sooner than what Tesla's doing, in my opinion.
Yeah. Watch, this is Figure, right? Specifically mm-hmm. with BMW and Agility. Those are the two that I think are light years ahead. All right. Mine, in case you missed it this week, has to do with Kubota. They hit a new record in terms of the size of the penalty they have to pay for mislabeling made in USA parts. Kubota North America was just hit with a $2 million civil penalty for misrepresenting the origins of replacement parts for tractors and other agricultural equipment. The penalty comes after a Federal Trade Commission complaint said Kubota, since at least 2021, falsely labeled thousands of imported parts as made in the USA, allegedly. Kubota also failed to update product labels after parts were outsourced, allegedly. According to the FTC, the company sold millions of mislabeled parts, and the $2 million penalty is the largest made in the USA labeling rule violation in history. Now, I chose this for a number of reasons. One, it made history. Like, we hear about people complaining about these things all the time. And to see a manufacturer such as Kubota North America get hit with something like that, that is an incredible, let's just say, compliance mistake when it comes to labeling. If we just want to say that at a base level, it's just a labeling problem.
Allegedly.
As part of the settlement, Kubota is prohibited from making unqualified origin claims from for products unless it can prove the product meets labeling conditions. Now, this particular one stood out to me because they're like,
wait a minute. Did they just say they're not allowed to lie?
Yeah. You can't
do it again. Hey, guys.
Yeah.
No lying.
But if you can get this, this has happened before. And I don't know if they had the specific stipulation where they said, whoa, 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 as part of the settlement, you can't do it again. See, they forgot that last time, which is how they slipped in this little mess here. Subsidiary Kubota Tractor Company previously violated the FTC Act when it advertised garden and lawn tractors as made in the United States, despite containing significant imported parts. But this time, they're going to get it. They're mm-hmm. going to get it right this time. I'm really confident. And, I mean, I want to say to their credit, Nolan Beilstein, who put this story together for us, he reached out to Kubota for a comment, and they shared a heck of a statement where they essentially admitted it. They said they cooperated with the investigation. They also said that they've implemented policies and process improvements, including regular reviews of supplier information and label accuracy. My only question is it gonna take this time, Jeff?
Man, so we're looking at tens of millions of parts, and it's a $2 million fine.
Yeah. But the biggest. Which,
so like 20 cents a part.
Oh, I think that's low. Like,
that's where this kind of hits me. And actually, I gave Nolan some crap before. This was a great story. This is really interesting stuff. So that's, again, we get back, we're running in circles here about we want the government to do more, but we don't want it to be heavily involved in private industry. Well, come on, Kubota. I mean, you know what you were. They knew what they were doing. This is another cultural thing here. Yeah. This was a defined practice. There's no way it wasn't when it was that prominent, when you're taking parts that came from someplace else and putting a USA sticker on them. Mm-hmm. They knew what they were doing. And you know what? The workers knew what they were doing when they were doing it. Their supervisors knew what they were doing when they were dropping off the labels. The purchasing department knew what they were doing. I mean, this permeated throughout. There's no way this was a big internal secret, okay?
Yeah.
So this is a cultural issue. The fine should have been much, much more if they did it. They haven't been.
Allegedly.
No guilt as a result of the settlement.
I mean, they've essentially admitted they did it, but they haven't actually been slapped on the wrist yet, which is basically what this is. And how does this, even if it is a record-setting fine, what precedent does this set to other manufacturers? If I'm the competitors here and I see this, I am outraged. Mm-hmm. Unless I'm doing the same thing. I mean,
then you're a little tight-lipped.
Then you're like,
I bet they're not going to do it again.
Because if this does become a competitive advantage when you're trying to compete on price and they're saying these are made in the USA parts in our machinery, somebody else's actually are. I mean, you're not going to be able to keep up with them from a price perspective.
Right.
So, yeah, like I said, it should be higher. It should be more, but at least it's something, I guess.
One thing that stood out to me, Anna, is that in other industries, truth in labeling, like getting the label wrong, is enough to get your entire operation shut down.
Yeah, that's true. But manufacturers do, because it's such a coveted designation to be made in the USA, you see that in other industries where they get really tricky with the wording because you know they're trying to deceive the consumer, even though they would never admit that. But like you see like assembled in the USA with global
globally sourced parts
or globally supplied materials or something like that. But when you see it, you know, maybe you gloss over the details there. I don't know. Everyone's trying to like position themselves as being made in the USA. It's such an important buying decision for some people to include that. So obviously you can see why they did it. And to Jeff's point, like, not really a deterrent when you consider how much they sold on the backs of this claim. And again, you know, so they're going to work harder to review supplier labeling. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Pass the
it
box.
Was, yep. It was definitely your suppliers and their labels.
All right, everybody sit down, sit down. Don't ever do it again. Right. Okay, right. Let's have lunch.
Sounds like you chose this story because it reminded you of conversations you have with your sons.
Exactly. Where you tell them not to do it. They say, of course. And then you have them repeat it back to you. Just like, what'd you do? I did this. Are you going to do it again? Absolutely not. Immediately do it again.
Yeah, then they do it right in front of you.
To which all I do is a simple breathing exercise. I certainly don't go off the rails. Never.
Well, we were talking about before, you're really good at letting things go.
Yeah.
Just let it be.
Yeah. Just water off a duck's back that festers inside of you for the entirety of your life. Yeah. Jeff, what's your In Case You Missed It this week?
So my In Case You Missed It, and before I get into this, I want to make it clear I'm not bashing electric vehicles.
But is that
I
a think pun? This, that's like a story pun.
Bashing electric
because
vehicles.
Because this story is bashing electric vehicles.
Well, kind of. So the story is test crashes show that the nation's guardrails cannot handle these heavier EVs. So basically this happened, the story emanates from the University of Nebraska, where basically they were testing, you know, the traditional guardrails that we have set up along highways and byways all across the U.S., and they were seeing how they could handle these bigger electric vehicles because they are, in some cases, as much as 50% heavier than their gas counterparts. So the vehicle that they used was a Rivian. It's a 4-ton 2022 Rivian RT1T. And if you see this thing hit this guardrail, now I have no delusions about what guardrails can stop and what they cannot, okay? Mm-hmm. They're guardrails. They're not walls. They're not meant to bring something to an abrupt stop. They're meant to slow it down, provide guidance, whatever. But when you see this vehicle absolutely smoke this guardrail, it does lead to the fact that we have got some work to do.
Yeah.
I mean, we talk a lot about a lot of the infrastructure changes that we need to make to accommodate EVs. It seems like that's the one we're going with. That's sort of the winner right now in terms of getting away from fossil fuels. Yeah, you just watched it.
guardrail didn't stand a chance.
Turn over to the video version if you're just listening to the podcast, just to see David's facial expression when he sees this Rivian smoke the guardrail.
It doesn't even like in the one angle. It doesn't even like
it does not
slow
even,
it down.
It does not even slow it down. No. So as we get more and more of these vehicles on the road, we've talked about the infrastructure from a charging perspective. This is another big piece of the puzzle here, okay? Mm-hmm. We are going to have to figure this one out because essentially this is the equivalent of lining up like, you know, paper streamers on the side of the road to try to keep people from going off if they're in an accident. So there's a lot of work to do here. We've got millions of miles of roads that these guardrails are on. It's going to take some time. But the good news is, as the article explains, we've been there before.
Yeah.
When vehicle owners started transitioning to more trucks and more SUVs, we went through the same process in the 70s and 80s. When trucks got bigger and we were driving faster, more power, they're hitting these guardrails much harder than in the past, even though the vehicles were super heavy then as well. So there have been adjustments in the past. We can do it again. But it's another one of those things we talk about, infrastructure investment. It's not real sexy. Doesn't get a lot of headlines.
Yeah.
But it's going to be really important to replace all this stuff. And there's also then an opportunity that comes along with this for suppliers and construction jobs and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. No, that was when I saw this story. My first misconception was that when I saw guardrails and EV in the headline, I was like, I thought like regulatory guardrails. And then it's like, oh, no, it's
the actual thing.
The actual things. Don't worry. I will say, okay, so one thing I love about working for a manufacturing and design engineering publications is that all of our readers do this. Right. So there's on IEN, Mr. Rosenfield or M. Rosenfield. I'm going to call him Mr. Rosenfield because, you know, let's be polite. He says, let's not just single out EVs unfairly. He was part of a test where he had to crash a 2017 Explorer, a police cruiser, into a similar barrier. And he says same results, just blew the barrier apart. And I mean, that's kind of goes to your part where it's like not necessarily supposed to stop. It's, you know, just kind of.
Yeah, ideally, you're not hitting this head on like in this video.
Yeah.
But it illustrates the point that even if this was coming in from the side,
it's not
going to do anything. I mean, it's really going to be ineffective. So, again, not the end of the world. We've got solutions here. We know how to fix this, but it is going to be something when you see those workers on the side of the road doing this and you throw my tax dollars are putting up that. Well, yeah, man.
Yeah.
We have to do this.
It's just broadcasting this video over it. The video was incredible. And unfortunately, one of the things that is kind of like symbolic of a Midwestern winter is seeing the mangled guardrails, especially after a snowstorm.
I mean, just like around.
Just like, ooh, doesn't look like that went really well.
Mm-mm, no.
But I mean, to Jeff's point, this is something that when you think of infrastructure and things that need to change and be improved to realize a different future. Well, I mean, I don't know. If we go more autonomous, is this something that maybe doesn't need to be upgraded? Or is this something that, you know, needs to be fixed in the interim?
Thank you for the very targeted question.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
I'm not feeling like autonomous development right now. That's not something that's like on my radar in terms of being a near term solution for anything.
Okay. Like we don't need to fix the guardrails. They'll all be driving themselves in 5 years.
Yeah. I don't believe that to be true.
Yeah.
But I do agree with some of the points that were made around not unfairly blaming EVs for the fact that like we have a heavy vehicle problem in general.
Yeah.
Because looking at this, I had no idea, but these guardrails are apparently only rated to take on 5,000 pounds. Mm. 5,000 pound vehicles is what. So like, I mean, F-150s weigh more than that.
Yeah.
Like semi trucks weigh more than that.
Yeah.
Like, so this whole time, all of them have been driving around with impunity and then EVs get targeted for blowing up a guardrail. That's, I mean.
Well, look at this EV blow up.
I did see it. Oh, but my point is you could do the same thing with an F-150.
Yes.
So, you know, same test. So, and to this Mr. Rosenthal.
Rosenfield.
Mm-hmm. Your points are well taken. I think that, and yeah, I know it's not sexy if we have to bolster every single one of these, but you know, maybe that's like the road we were headed down already with good everybody point. Buying yeah. SUVs and trucks, heavy trucks and stuff. I mean, that's kind of already what everybody was doing. So
it kind of should have already been done, just in terms of infrastructure improvements. And I'm sure now that this has come to light, everyone's going to get on it. And we should see these upgraded guardrails in about 2 to 3 years, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. It's a good day to be a guardrail manufacturer.
You know, I bet Congress will just put their heads together and just pass it already, just like the guardrail.
Bipartisan
Infrastructure Act of 2024.
I would love to see the political divide. Actually, I know how it would be written, but just like, wait a second. You're anti-guardrail? No. I'm anti-government spending and picking winners for these guardrail manufacturers. Just like, can we just make some?
Nope.
Mm-mm. All right. Well, before we get out of here, let's do our final thoughts. Anna, what do you have as a final thought?
I don't know about you guys, but this week has been like I've had some mixed feelings about the weather lately. So it's like, you know, late January, early Feb, and it's hit 40 a couple times in the last week, which is a relief because I hate normally it's like 0 degrees right now in Wisconsin, but also like, oh, why is it so warm? I hope that's all El Nino.
Yeah.
Talking.
Should be fine.
So just feeling some guilt about enjoying it, but I'm just trying to enjoy it anyway.
I mean, I know I'm getting older because I enjoyed the warm weather because it finally revealed all of my buried Christmas decorations that remained frozen in the ground. I could finally get those up. As to whether or not they work anymore after kids have played on them for 3 weeks, I don't know.
Yeah, for us, it's like there's just like sleds everywhere that are just like, oh, what's this? Another sled. Mm-hmm. And then, and like chalk that would like never got. Yeah, chalk, yeah. Just chalk everywhere.
I mean, anyone with kids know what that backyard looks like. Yeah. Or, I mean, with animals for that matter. my final thought this week was just that, you know, a lot of times I talk about blood donation, stuff like that. It's nothing in particular with like mental health awareness. Just saying that, you know, it's always good to be on the lookout and help people when they are in need. And that if you ever need a hand, you shouldn't be afraid to ask for it. So just sending a note out there to that. If anyone ever needs a step up, that there are people out there that are willing to help you. And you shouldn't be afraid to ask for help. Jeff, your final thought this week.
Did you see like the Red Cross now sends out where your blood actually went?
Oh, yeah. It's awesome.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Wow.
Did see that. My final thought, a little less serious than yours.
Yeah, sorry.
So between the holidays, we got another cat. Mm-hmm. And we've had two cats before. And one was older. One was a kitten. Didn't really work out. But these two are closer in age. And if you're going to get a kitten, get two.
Okay.
Because it is entertaining. Yeah. It is absolutely hilarious watching these cats fight because the one's way overweight and the other one's still too small.
Yeah.
But like the big one will come up and just like look at him. And you know, cats are so passive aggressive about everything. It's kind of like, I mean, if you like want to fight or something, we could, I guess, whatever. So yeah. The other one like jumps on him and then the big one like pins him, just kind of looking around. It is hilarious to watch these cats go after it. I think I enjoy it more because raising daughters, they don't fight like boys did, like my brother and I did.
Yeah.
I mean, we would push and shove and, you know, throw fists and stuff, whereas girls were much meaner.
Yeah.
Like they were brutal. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I'm just enjoying this. And my advice is, I can't believe I'm saying this, but if you get a kitten, just get two because there's entertainment value.
I see you just like walking into the living room, like the other cat's in the middle of the room. And you just like
throw
the cat right next to it and just yell like, this is Sparta. Like,
well, and my wife gets freaked out because the little one will start hissing and stuff. I'm like, no, he started it. And he's going to start it again as soon as the big one walks away.
Just like, yeah. Let it play
he's
out.
He's fine. Yeah. He's fine.
It's hilarious. I love it.
Talking about kids fighting, like I never knew like the distinct sound of like a toddler's fist hitting baby flesh.
Oh.
And it is a very distinct sound. Just that like crack. And you're like, maybe they're fine. No, they're not fine. But in all that, you talk about like fighting with your brothers or whatever, all the same things are in play. Where it's like sometimes you don't hear the fight, but then all of a sudden from the other room, I'll hear, oh no, you just hit me. No, don't go tell him. Don't go tell him. You can just hit me. It'll be funny.
Or like you were the older brother, but I was the younger one. So like the same dynamic where like, you know, you would basically be handled and put away and then be like, whatever, here I come again.
Oh, yeah.
And the same thing would happen.
I did not grow up like this, you guys.
No, it is.
I have two brothers and I would just put them in their place just like verbally. And they would just be like,
ugh. That's because, I have no idea that's what because that's like. Girls are mean.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
They are so much meaner.
Proving your point, I guess.
No, it's we have the same back and forth at home because my wife grew up similar to you. We're like, it's just like, no, mind games. And we're just like, no. We broke the house down.
Yeah.
Broke it down.
Just fight.
All right. Well, before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our daily and weekly newsletters. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. And subscribe to us on YouTube at IN Magazine so you can join us whenever we go live every Thursday. For Jeff Ranke and Anna Wells, I'm David Manti. This is the Today in Manufacturing Podcast, and we'll see you next week.